Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm kind of supposed to be dead. So if I end up not being in a massive rush to write my second novel, I think that's reasonably understandable.
Hello, writers. Welcome back to Write Off, the podcast about writing rejection in all its forms, from self-doubt to books not selling. I'm your host, Francesca Steele, a journalist and writer based in London. And if you want to know more about my own experience with writing rejection, you can hear about that in the first season. I am so delighted to have Robert Webb on Write Off today. His memoir, How Not to Be a Boy, is one of my favourite books, a raw and insightful look at Robert's background, what I think we would now call toxic masculinity and its ripple effects throughout childhood and adulthood, and the death of his mother when he was 17. Robert has also written a terrific novel, Come Again, which is about a woman grieving for her late husband who suddenly finds herself back in time at university on the day she meets him. Robert is, of course, an actor and comedian as well as a writer, and he is probably best known as the star of Peep Show, which he worked on with David Mitchell for 12 years. The duo, who met at university, had their big break in their late 20s when they joined a BBC writing team, and Peep Show came a few years later. But before that, they worked for years sketchwriting and being rejected all over the place, as most freelancers are. I love talking to Rob about how during that time he tried to reconcile himself to not making it big, and also how difficult it is writing a second novel when the idea for the first one arrived like a lightning bolt. I did not get a chance to ask Rob about being a Booker judge this year because it hadn't been announced when we spoke, but he is one, so look out for that. Just by the by, in this interview I refer to a Hemingway quote. After the interview I checked this, and it is in fact commonly misattributed to him. Hemingway apparently did not say write drunk, edit sober, and it's probably also very bad advice, so let's ignore it anyway. Okay, let's listen to Rob.
Yes, I was freakishly young. I was about 13, I think, and I was watching. I mean, I loved all the stuff that we talk about these days as being the classics. That, you know, the repeats of 40 Towers and The Young Ones. I loved that, but it was actually a long forgotten sitcom that was the sort of moment that I thought, "Ooh, could I do that?" And it was a thing called Home Sweet Home, starring the very young Martin Clunes, and it was a very BBC One, very trad family sitcom, and I'd just been in a play at school, and I'd got the sort of lead part by accident because the person who wrote it had suddenly got appendicitis, and I stepped into with far-reaching consequences for me, but Paul was fine. His appendix, that was all fine. So I didn't, you know, nobody had to die in order for me to have my start in acting. But I'd just done that, and I'd got some laughs, and I remember the feeling of control, I suppose, is the first. I mean, it's nice to inspire joy. Obviously, that's the obvious thing. But actually, being able to time laughs and being able to, you know, knowing that the way that you cross your leg at this point, or the way that you inflect this word at this point, is going to make a difference to how this audience reacts. That wasn't immediately obvious in this performance when I was 13, but that kind of feeling, yes, I liked the look of that. And then I was watching Martin Clunes and I thought, what is this young man doing that I couldn't do? I thought to myself, all of 13. So the idea that you could do that and get paid for it, and that that could be your job, was very exciting. And then very shortly after that, I started writing as well. I started writing sort of sketches and stuff that we would do. I would make my friends take all of the non-funny parts, and I would have the funny parts in sort of reviews, basically. Although I didn't know it was called that, but sketch shows that we would do at the end of term, and we charged 10p, and most of the school would turn up and see it. And nominally it was for team building and raising money for charity, but essentially it was for me to show off. And I was sort of indulged in that by a couple of excellent teachers. So it was it all started there, really, the writing and the acting at the same time.
You were always focused on comedy, it sounds like. Did you have any intention at that point of writing anything like a novel? I mean, you write in your memoir, you write a fair bit in your diary, quite dramatically at points, in the way one does as a teenager, I suppose. But was a novel, you were reading a lot at that time, I know. Was a novel on your mind at all?
It was always sort of in the background. I mean, it's funny, when I came to write my first novel, so far my only novel, but let's just to keep me on my toes, my first novel, Come Again. When I came to that, it was pleasing actually to remember that at primary school, I'd excelled at creative writing. There was a lesson during the week called creative writing. And again, you're right, it was still very focused on comedy, and I was doing it because I wanted to make my friends laugh. But it was pleasing to me that it wasn't like going from comedy script writing to writing a novel wasn't so much this big step into the unknown, that it was a kind of a circling back, in that I started with stories, really, that I've been writing stories before I was writing sort of stuff for the stage. So I think humans like that. They like the idea that we're going in circles, and that we've done this thing before, and this is now closing some arc. So I'd always enjoyed writing stories, but for a long time this stage stuff and then radio and TV stuff kind of overtook that, simply because that's just where my focus was. But I think a novel had always been sort of simmering in the background.
Yeah, and so let's talk about that comedy stuff then. Obviously, you met David Mitchell at university at Cambridge Footlights and went on to write with him and perform with him. In the email you sent me about some of the rejections you'd experienced before we recorded this podcast, you mentioned both submitting comedy with David to the BBC in various places and having rejected. And you also mentioned your, and I quote, insanely large ego. I wouldn't want anybody to think that I'd said that about you, but that is how you referred to it yourself. So let's talk about that a little bit. You were submitting, being rejected, and you were horribly arrogant at the same time. Tell me about that.
I certainly was. Well, it was this sort of horrifying step from my third year at Cambridge, where, you know, I was vice president of Footlights and I was doing shows with David was in his second year at the time, and I started working with him. We were doing two-man shows and I was in all three Footlights shows, and I starred in two of them. I directed the other one. I had my own column in Varsity, the student newspaper. It was all going, you know, hilariously. You know, I was really quite grand, and in that very small pond, sort of famous. And then you go from that to living in the flat above Iceland in Swiss Cottage, and you know, you're living on pot noodle and toast, and you you're an usher at a theatre, coping with bad-tempered middle-class theatre goers who are very cross that you won't let them walk into the show when they're 10 minutes late, all of that, and just being utterly anonymous and just starting from scratch again. So it was quite a bump, and I, you know, I had a big face full of humble pie, and I was sort of going along to Weekending. So Weekending was this Radio 4 topical show that ran for many, many years, and it was one of the few sort of access shows. You could be nobody and just turn up with some sketches. And I remember submitting, I think, about five sketches the first week that I that I tried it, and they were all sent back. And I just kind of walked away in disgust and never submitted any sketches ever again, because it was a kind of I'd gone to Cambridge to sort of meet other people, to try and meet other people who thought they were funny, to find out whether I was funny or not. And I decided, to my satisfaction, yes, I was. and we were quite arrogant. I think it's a sort of self-preservation thing as well, though. You build these defenses, and I think I did that in other ways, and not just professionally as well, that that's how your insecurity comes out sometimes, in that, you know, well, if this person doesn't understand me, then it just goes to show what an idiot they are. And it was a bit like that with also, in my defense, sometimes when you're starting out, you won't necessarily be working with Kubrick, you know, you know the person who's not to have a go at whoever was script editing Weekending at that time, and who missed my obvious genius. But I'm giving myself a pass there, because I think the sketches, I have no idea. If I read those sketches now, they might be absolutely dreadful, because I knew nothing about writing radio comedy. But anyway, I didn't try that again. And then once David graduated, and we were doing stuff together, and we got an agent, and she got us meetings with producers at the BBC and elsewhere, and we started writing for other people's sketch shows. And we sort of became known within the business way before we were known anywhere else. And so we got a thing called a first look deal with the BBC, which is where they gave us some money, for which we were extremely grateful, to try and pilot various projects, like write a sitcom pilot or write on other people's shows. And so we would do things like that, things that were amazingly complicated to explain to my grandfather, for example. He was kind of go, "What are you up to at the moment, Rob?" And I would say, "Well, it's a thing called..." And I'd sort of waffle like this for a while, and then he would go, "Well, let's hope some good comes out of that." And we'd agree that we both hoped that some good would come out of that. But we were sort of subsisting like that for years, and stuff that we were submitting to broadcasters, which in retrospect, I can kind of see their point, that they were never going to make these fantastically expensive looking sitcoms and comedy shows with these two totally unknown people in them. But we were sort of doing that and getting increasingly scared, basically, that this was just never going to happen. We were kind of working as comedy writers, jobbing comedy writers, writing for other people's sketch shows like Armstrong and Miller, writing the links on the Jack Doherty show, stuff like that. And so we were making a living, but it kind of looked like it wasn't going to sort of, capital H, happen.
And of course, lots of people do live creative lives like that, where they work, absolutely. They can earn money, but they don't, you know, they don't, it doesn't, well, it happens, but it doesn't happen with a capital H. When you thought that was going to be the case for you, what did that feel like?
It was, I like to think that, because it was so sort of gradual, and we never had that kind of, we never had an instant thing. So this is like 95, Peep Show doesn't come along till 2003. So this is a reasonable, sort of apprenticeship, if you like. And, you get time, you've got time to get used to the idea that you might be a bit disappointed, and actually this is the life, and you don't have to be famous, and you don't have to be the be all and end all, and actually earning money from writing is great, isn't it? Because it is, and I certainly wasn't qualified to do anything else at that point. So we were sort of lowering our horizons, I suppose. And and then after it kind of happens, you realize that, success has its own, it can be a bit of a double-edged thing itself. But obviously, given the choice, it was better after it started working out for us than it was before. But yeah, it was like that for quite a long time. But I think we were reconciling ourselves to that.
Were you able to enjoy the writing? And obviously, particularly given that it's funny writing, are you able to sit there in moments of deflation and rejection and bounce around jokes with your writing partner and kind of enjoy it all, or does it start to feel very difficult?
It varied depending on the job and depending on the day, really. I mean, if we were writing sketches for someone who we knew was going to send back a load of notes that didn't make any sense, and that were, we would literally sometimes you know, for our own private amusement, we would call the document of the second draft worse. There we go, the same title and then brackets worse, and hopefully remember to change it back again before we submit it to the whoever it was. So that's
such a risky game.
Yeah, I know. I think I would have been at the keyboard. David would never have done that. That would have been me. So it sort of depended. A lot of the time, yes, when we sort of got into the flow of, by the time we were writing our own show, for example, or writing stuff that we knew we were going to perform, and there was a thing called Bruiser where we knew we were going to be in it, and we got quite a good system where we would meet in the evening and we would turn up at the pub with a couple of notebooks, and we would try and emerge basically vertical by the end of the night with four or five decent ideas for sketches, and then write them up the following afternoon. We weren't morning writers at that point. So we would, you know, I would turn up at David's house. We would have a very long cup of tea watching Buffy or Morse or whatever happened to, or the snooker or whatever happened to be on. Not much got done during Crucible Fortnite, I can tell you that, because we just found the commentators hilarious more than we love the snooker. Anyway, we would go up, and then at one point, you know, one of us would wearily say to the other one, shall we do a bit then? And we would trudge up to David's bedroom, and we would do, because we were working together so much, like we would see each other literally every day, that the clock was ticking. By the time we sat down in those chairs, we didn't want to be in that room any longer than we had to be. So we became very efficient, and so we would knock off go through a couple of drafts of four or five sketches in 3 hours, and then I'd go home. And if you do that every day, you produce a lot of material, and by the time we were doing our own shows for Radio 4 and then BBC 2, we were quite practiced in being able to overwrite, essentially being able to have enough redundancy that you could get rid of the sketches that you thought were quite good and only record the ones that you thought were very good. And so that stood us in that sort of long apprenticeship, if you like, was very handy by the time it did all start to pick up.
I think that's such an interesting word, apprenticeship, because obviously there is no formal apprenticeship in creativity, and most people struggle with that, you know, the idea that you have to be great straight out the gate, and if you're not, you'll be binned and won't be able to work. But maybe in comedy, where you start off smaller, and you know, I'm just thinking about compared with, say, debut novelists. Mm. Not in your case, perhaps, because you already had a platform by that stage. But a lot of debut novelists feel that their books have to be brilliant the very first time round, and obviously, if they don't sell thousands of copies the first time round, they feel that maybe they won't have that chance in an apprenticeship.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny because I came at the sort of publishing books world from this weird angle, having established this profile as a performer as much as anything else. The good side of that was, you know, it really helps you to get a book deal. But there again, you know, I went to enormous trouble to make sure the proposal for How Not to Be a Boy, which was the first book, was a lot, how can I put this, better than it needed to be, but looked like I knew what I was doing. And so I wrote the first two chapters, and then I wrote another 30 pages outlining what was going to be in the rest of the book. And I just wanted to give publishers a very good idea that I wanted to give them the firm impression that I knew what I was doing. And I think that helped me have the idea that I knew what I was doing.
That's so interesting, because if I'm honest, because I know that came out, I mean, I think, am I right in thinking you were approached off the back of a New Statesman column for, No.
The idea came from me. I sort of, the column did go down very well. And that was also called, you know, that was the, basically that column, which was called How Not to Be a Boy, was, if you like, the sort of nucleus of the book that followed. But it wasn't intended as that. It was just a longer than usual and more personal than usual and more memoirish, if you like, than usual column that I was for the New Statesman, because I was writing occasionally for them at the time. And then I went to my literary agent, Ivan Mulcahy, and said, how about a memoir, but it's focused on masculinity and gender conditioning in boys and how boys are supposed to be boys and how I found that quite difficult. What does that sound like to you? And he said, that sounds great. Why don't you write some pages and let me have a look? And that's how that sort of process started. But the idea came from me, really. So, I mean, what I was going to say about you know, starting coming to books from the world of TV is that it gave me a huge help in terms of profile and in terms of getting a deal. On the other hand, it added a certain amount of pressure, because you were saying, you know, you don't, you know, a debut novelist or a debut writer of a memoir, what it felt like to me is you don't get to fuck this up quietly, basically. So it was like,
yeah,
it has to be good. That's how I felt about it. And I think that's why I gave myself such a head start before anybody saw it.
I think that makes sense. And I mean, I would add here that I was saying this to you before we started recording, but it is such a phenomenal book. I mean, certainly one of my favorite memoirs of all time, if not one of my favorite books of all time.
That's very kind. Thank you very much, Francesca.
It really is. I just think it's one of the cleverest, in most insightful looks at how the idea of what's masculine in a sort of gendered society hurts men as much as it hurts women. There's one bit I really, really remember where you've just written, as a teenager, you've just written quite a nasty letter to a girl in the wake of your mother's death. And you say, and I quote, "In other words, the girl picked up the bill when the boy turned fear and grief into anger." And I just think it's a very, very clever way of looking at what encouraging boys to be boys really does to boys and to women and to society in general. It's a fantastic book. If you haven't read it, people who are listening, please do.
Thank you.
But I know that you said then that in the email that you sent me before this, you mentioned that the deal came quite easily for that and for Come Again, your novel, but not the writing. So I know you've just said you felt keen to make that proposal better than it needed to be. How about then when you got the deal and you got writing, how was that?
It was, to be honest, with the first book, it wasn't too bad, because I think partly because I'd given myself this roadmap is the horrible word that just came to mind, but I had this plan, and it was hard in the sense that it was emotionally challenging some of the time, because I was, even though there's a satisfaction to being able to frame these events, for example, you know, my mum died when I was 17, and being able to sort of express that in my own words was I think was cathartic for me, although I'm always slightly shy of admitting that, because it sounds like the book is like for my benefit, rather than, because the whole tone of the book hopefully is that it's quite open and it's out to reach out to other people, to particularly when you've lost someone, that what you really need to hear is that you're not alone, and that we've all gone through these, we've all lost someone. So it was good for me. I completely lost my thread now.
I think you were saying that it was cathartic, but yes, not, that wasn't your primary goal, but nonetheless, no, it was emotionally challenging to write.
Yes, that's right. It was emotionally challenging. So yeah, so we were dealing with some quiet, and you know, my relationship with my dad and what I've been like with women and stuff around alcohol, stuff around suicidal thoughts, depression. There are various sort of hot topics in the book, to put it glibly. And so it was challenging to write. It should also be added, I was still, and this is also true of Come Again, which I found much harder to write, that I was still drinking quite a lot while I was writing these two books. Now, that's not to say that I was sort of staggering around and I don't want people to think, but this is the work of a drunkard, I'm not reading this anymore. It was all quite carefully done in the end. It was all quite carefully edited and carefully put together and approached with great seriousness. But the truth is also, you know, during those first drafts of both books, if I tried to get behind a wheel of a car, I'd be rightly arrested. And I think that might be partly why in my head I'm finding it harder to write now, but for reasons that I'm sure we'll get to, I don't drink anymore. I certainly, you know, I really don't think there's a thing called, I can't get it, remember if it's permission beliefs or belief permissions, it's one or the other, but things that addicts tell themselves in order to justify their addiction. And I think there was a time when I thought that that alcohol helped me to write. I think I believed that, or it was convenient for me to believe that it made my mind more lateral and that I could make leaps that I wouldn't otherwise
make. I think that's quite a common feeling, not justified, but you know, right drunk, edit sober, isn't that the Hemingway?
Yeah, I think it's not. I mean, you know, everyone's different, but I think in my case it's absolute nonsense, and it certainly slowed me down. I certainly know that if I'd been drinking a lot and I came to look at what I'd been doing yesterday, you could quite reliably just delete the last 400-600 words, because they'll be gibberish or suddenly very angry or bitter, but the jokes would stop. I'd just get tired, and then I'd just stop being funny now, because being funny is harder than being solemn. So that's
so interesting. And I actually wanted to ask you about that, because both books, I would say, are really funny, but you know, not in a peep show way, in a comedy on the radio or the TV way, because they have to exist in an entirely different format, in the format of, you know, an edited line, an edited paragraph, an edited narrative arc, which, not to say that your TV shows and your radio shows don't have those, but it's just different, I think.
It is different. And you know, I always take it with a pinch of salt when you read on the back cover of something, don't read this on the train, otherwise, unless you want to be seen guffawing like an idiot. You're going to go, this book isn't going to make you guffaw like an idiot. Not in the same way that Brass Eye is or The Peep Show is. You know, it's just a different thing. It's a sort of Julian Barnes level of funny, which is funny, but it's not funny in the same way. You know, not no disrespect to Mr. Barnes, but you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean.
There's only so far that form can take you. But
was it difficult for you to sort of write in that different format and either, as you say, you know, notice that?
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Writing comedy was harder than not doing it, or was it difficult to tone that down in some way to accommodate this new format?
It's the great pleasure of it is that it appeals to the egomaniac in me, because or the control freak, if you like, because you get to do all the jobs. I mean, compared to if you're writing a script, then you're handing it over to an actor, assuming the actor isn't you, but you're handing it over to other actors. And you're also, there will be all these talented people who, and it's brilliant when you're in that collaborative mood and you're in that collaborative form, and there'll be the director and the producer will put certain constraints on it and the budget, obviously, and the, you know, you're not necessarily in charge of what people are wearing or how it's edited or what we're listening to or any of that stuff. And suddenly you come to write a novel and you're doing everything. You're in charge of where the camera is, if you like, and you're in charge of, you know, how people look and how people sound. And of course you hand over that control to the reader, and that somehow that's absolutely fine. I don't mind giving the reader that control, because, you know, they will do the voices in their own heads and I have absolutely no control over that, and that's fine. Whereas when you give it to another actor and they do it wrong, then there's nothing. You just have to pretend that you're okay with that, even though you're sort of, you know, privately jumping. I mean, this is why I would be a terrible director, and I mustn't be allowed to direct anything, because I would just want to act everything.
Noted for posterity.
I just want to walk up to the actors and do it for them. And go, no, obviously not like that, love. So it's good for me.
But isn't it easier as well for self-doubt to creep in when you don't have that collaboration, and particularly for somebody who'd been working so closely with someone else for so long? Suddenly yes. You're in a room by yourself, or I think it was the garden where you did a lot of your writing and drinking.
I did a lot of writing in the garden because I was smoking as well as everything else. Yeah, with David, there was a sort of safety in numbers thing, in that if one of us found something funny, then okay, it might be funny. If both of us found it funny, yes, we're going to write that. If neither of us find it funny, then obviously we're not going to do it. So it was there was a kind of safety net there, and we were honest with each other without being dismissive or rude. We played really nicely. I mean, that was the only way that we could, you know, work together so closely for so long. It was a very, very polite relationship. And there are ex-girlfriends that I should have treated with that much respect, and it would have been a better time for everyone. We never fell out exactly. We would have differences, but you know, they would be dealt with there would be the odd tetchy silence followed by icy English courtesy, picking up the pieces, and then we'd feel better about it a bit later. So there was that aspect. So when you come to do it on your own, on the one hand, yes, you don't have that backup voice. On the other hand, to be honest, having worked with David for so long, it was just this luxury that I've never quite got over yet, of being able to really take your time and look, if I want to spend 10 minutes deciding where this comma goes, I'm allowed. And nobody, you know, I'm not wasting anyone's time. Not that he was constantly tapping his foot, but like I say, the clock was ticking when we were together writing side by side, and you just didn't want to lean back on your chair and stare out of the window and really, really take your time about this. There was a sort of inbuilt review efficiency in that script writing system that just wasn't relevant by the time you come to doing a novel. I mean, I couldn't write a novel with him. I mean, that doesn't tend to happen anyway. But I'm still sort of luxuriating in being able to take my time and being completely in charge and not having to negotiate with anyone. You lose everyone else's talented input, but you gain a sort of unity, this is definitely my thing. I'm going to take all the credit and I'm going to take all the blame. And it's kind of exciting like that.
As a journalist, I have a similar relationship with writing when I've written fiction, and compared with journalism, where I sort of love the autonomy but hate it equally.
Yeah.
I think. So how did you find writing a novel after all that? Because the memoir was very successful. It was a bestseller. It was highly praised and so on. And then you had the novel as part of the same deal? Was it already on? Okay. And so how were you feeling about that?
So the idea for Come Again actually preceded the idea for the memoir. It was an idea I'd had about 5 years previously. And I remember exactly how it happened. I was just sitting in, I was filming Peep Show, and I was sitting in Jeremy's car, and they were re-rigging the lights, and there was just a bit of a pause. And I was on my phone and it was on social media, and somebody, a director I just worked with, said, okay, I've just finished that project. Has anyone got any great ideas for a story? And I just remember staring out of the front windscreen and unfocusing my eyes. And this idea just fell into my lap, and it basically ruined me, because I've Come Again came out 3 years ago, and I've spent 3 years chasing that experience. And it's taken me a very, very long time to work out that it's probably never going to happen like that again. Yeah, middle-aged widow travels back in time, meets future dead husband. He's not the man that she lost. He's the annoying English student that she first met. What do you do? So, I mean, it was right there, and I kind of wrote that down, and then I sort of did nothing with it. And then when it came to, you know, pitching the memoir, it was suggested to me that if you've got an idea for a novel in your back pocket, then this might be the time to, you know, tag it onto the proposal, just to make them think that you might be a proper writer in some way. So there was this 50-page document for How Not to Be a Boy, and this half a page, this three paragraphs of Come Again sort of tagged on. And on the basis of that, they all offered, the people who offered a two-book deal. So I came to Come Again, and again, there's a huge difference between starting the memoir and starting this, and that I'd half written the book by the time I came to actually do it the first time round, and this time I just had this half a page, and so it was really terrifying. And I think I went about I sort of knew that I wanted there to be sort of three sections. I knew there had to be a present day thing where she's in trouble. So we meet Kate and she's in terrible grief and she's not getting better and she's stuck in the past. And then magically she wakes up. It's 1992. This is the week. In fact, this is the day that she met Luke, her husband, for the first time. What is she going to do? And then I knew that she had to learn something in the past and bring that new knowledge back into the present and learn, basically learning to, it's about learning to live in the present. I say this in the full knowledge that it is a sort of rom-com thriller adventure that ends in a car chase and a punch-up. So let's not get too carried away with its thematic seriousness. But it's about movement from grief into mourning, from being stuck in the past to understanding that the new present has something to say for itself.
Yeah, I actually think you weave together all those serious thematic concerns really, really cleverly, because there are bits where it hops about. That quite hooky premise that was your initial thought is played with quite a lot. I mean, there are three, you know, discernible sections to the book. And I imagine that took quite a bit of drafting to get those three things to work together. I don't want to say too much about what they are, because I feel like a lot of the joy is in the surprise of them. But
I had a fairly good idea early on what needed to happen in the middle. And I had a slightly vaguer but some idea of how I wanted it to end. I'm very happy to say, this is not a spoiler, that the dead guy is not going to come back to life. I knew that if anybody comes back to life, it's Kate. It's about our heroine coming back to life. So I knew I had to find a satisfying ending that didn't cheat in that way. So I had these sort of three lampposts, and it was kind of a question of looping between them. And sometimes that was terrifying, and sometimes it was really exciting. So I knew, for example, I knew that I had to get her out of the house, and I've got her walking along the street, and she goes into a bookshop, and the sort of critic in my head is saying, well, why is she going into a bookshop? What's she going to do in the bookshop? And the sort of writer voice is saying, can you just shut up? She's gone into the bookshop. Okay, I don't know why she's going into the bookshop. Let her go into the bookshop. And so, you know, she picks up a thematically relevant book, and she meets an interesting, I hope, and funny character that she's friends with, and they have a disagreement, and that tells us something about her state of mind, and she leaves, and she's in a different state when she leaves than she was when she went in. And it turned out to be a very useful scene. So sometimes you kind of go, the critic needs to shut up so that the artist, if you like, can do their thing. And so moments like that were exciting, and you get little, and the more times that happens, you gain these little incremental feelings of confidence that it's okay to just let your pen go for a wander, and you're not going to end up down a blind alley. And if you do, that's okay. No one's going to die. It's fine. You can just start again from where it last made sense. So I panicked, and sometimes I just got a hold of myself and just let the whatever it is guide me, the muse.
Was it how you thought it would be, having coming full circle, as you said at the beginning? Yeah. Was it how you thought it would be after thinking of writing a story for so long and having had the idea of Come Again in your head for quite a long time? Was it everything you expected?
It was harder. It was harder, and it was slower. There's no doubt about that. It was certainly harder and slower than the memoir. And I think it was, the joy of it for me is always in the style and in the nitty gritty of the sentences. I love it. You know, you write something and you need to get rid of this unintentional rhyme, and you need to rearrange this syntax so that the rhythm is nicer for the reader. And you need to get all of the stuff that is going to distract the reader out of the way. or this joke is in the wrong place, it needs to be moved, or it needs to be turned up to 11 to make it work properly, or whatever. And just all of that stuff, the nitty-gritty of just removing those ruffles, the things that will stop the reader enjoying it because they're worried about something. Because I think it was Hitchcock that said a confused audience does not emote, and he's trying to scare them. Most of the time I'm trying to make them laugh, and they won't laugh if they're confused about something. So all of that work is what I really enjoy, and entertaining the audience, and sometimes hopefully touching them as well. If it's, you know, in the case of Come Again, it is quite a griefy, but if grief turns out to be my subject, then that's just what I'm stuck with, and there we are. But that's what I'm up to. Whereas the plot and structure and storytelling is, at the moment, it kind of feels like this kind of necessary evil that you have to. I thought the hook, as you, the hooky premise, I thought that was my idea. That I sort of thought I'd done the storytelling because I'd come up with that idea. And I went, oh, that's fine. I've got a story. And of course, that isn't the story at all. That's the beginning of a story. And I had a lot of work to do. So it's kind of integrating the storytelling with the enjoyment of the sentence to sentence-ness. That's what I've got to work on, and what I hope to improve on, basically.
Yes. Well, I want to ask you about your new book in just a sec. But before we move on to that, I just want to mention a particular bit of Come Again, which is very funny and very good. And there's one bit where Kate, as you say, is back in the past, meeting her in the present dead husband, Luke, for the very first time in Freshers Week, which, by the way, will make anyone who's been to university want to return there, and also definitely not in equal measure, I think. And anyway, she meets this Luke, and he's written a book. He wants her to read it and comment on it. And it's so bad. And I was just gonna read a wee bit. I mean, she says it's so bad. I hope I'm not like saying that you've written something that's really bad here that wasn't meant to be. But no, she's I'll just read you a little bit. The sky-high heels of Jessica Jedd tick across the asphalt, transporting the pneumatic breasts of their mistress and telling their own story as the multi-storied roof shimmers in the heat blur like a slab of sorbet grateful to melt. Her mind is empty, light as a plastic turd, empty like this car park roof, proof positive that Gary Disposal has made the grade. Oh, he's chosen the place to meet, all right. He'd abused the sheets of his fetid bed, they reeked, but he'd hung up the mouth can, exulted. She'd agreed. I read this, and I read it over a few times because I knew it was kind of intentionally bad, and that's the joke. But I was also like, I was sort of trying to unpick it, and I was quite fascinated by how you'd written the bad writing and whether you'd had a lot of fun with that and gone over it many times.
Yes.
And also whether these were your own concerns, this sort of, because it's very overwritten. It's not in that particular passage, but it's riddled with these sort of kind of random dead end literary references intended to make him look uber intellectual. I wondered if you could comment on how it was writing that wee bit.
It's funny. I read a while ago John Cleese saying that your sitcom monster is you minus your sense of humor. And you can kind of see that in Basil Fawlty, and you can see it in Partridge. And I think this is the kind of writer that I could have been if I'd if I'd been a different sort of person. It's partly, I think it's Luke under the heavy influence of early Martin Amis is what it is.
Yeah.
And it's a stupid person's idea of what good writing is, that it all has these little rhymes and these kind of references, and of course the unexamined sexism of it. Jessica Zedd, her mind is empty, and we hear about her breasts and all of that. I mean, I really like Martin Amis, but this is a sort of bad pastiche as written by someone who doesn't know what they're doing. Yes, yeah. I did have a lot of fun writing it, and yes, I did spend probably more time on those two paragraphs than I did on the surrounding chapter.
And when you're writing, do you worry about do you worry about things like overwriting, or if you are, as you are, very well read, it seems to me, do you worry about being unduly influenced by the things that you love and sort of putting them in a sort of, like you say, a sort of homage or pastiche? Or,
well, I've carried the English student guilt about never being well read enough. I mean, I just, you know, just constantly starting books that I think I ought to. I just turned 50, and I've only just got over the habit of not finishing books that I've started. I now can open a book in the knowledge that I don't have to finish it. It's fine, which is great, because it means I can open books that I really might not finish and just enjoy the first 40 pages. I'm reading Hilary Mantel's A Place of Greater Safety. It's an 800-page novel. I very much doubt I'm going to get to the end of it, but that, it's, in a way, that's great, because I'm enjoying it. I haven't stopped yet. I might well read it. I think I'm more likely to read it since I've given myself permission not to, if that makes any sense.
Yes,
so in terms of overwriting things, I feel quite strongly that if a sentence is drawing attention to itself, then it's probably getting in the way of the story. So I keep an eye on that. I try to only show off deliberately. If I'm showing off, then it needs to be serving a purpose. Yeah, the rest of the time, I'm trying to put all of my, whatever I've got, talent or hard work or luck or whatever is going on, into just making things easy for the reader. So in their different ways, I think Come Again and How Not to Be a Boy are quite complicated, but I take pride in making them extremely easy to read. You can knock these books off in a couple of hours. And I, you know, people say that they have, and I quietly get mixed feelings about that, because on the one hand, great, because I went out of my way to make this extremely accessible. And on the other hand, you've probably missed quite a lot of stuff. Would you mind reading it again, please?
I've actually read your memoir 3 times.
But I did
read it quite quickly the first time, because it is very good.
Well, that's what it begs. It begs to be read quickly, because
Just going back to that idea of ego, I do want to talk about your second novel in a second, but just very quickly, I don't think we've stressed in this interview so far that you actually had quite a difficult childhood, which is something that your memoir goes into a lot. And we mentioned that your mother died when you were 17, and I'm very sorry about that. You might write very movingly about it in the memoir, and I'm paraphrasing, but correct me if this is wrong, I think you felt slightly at odds with the kind of very masculine culture that you were growing up in. Your brothers were quite a bit sort of burlier than you, and you were quite into imaginative play and had these sort of imaginary friends. And, you know, I think you were sort of creative and not particularly, quote, masculine in a world that expected different things of you. I just wanted to ask, because I found it interesting that you had this ego then when you went to university or after you left it. Mm. I wanted to ask whether you think that if you had had a different childhood, you might not have become a writer in any of the myriad forms that you are now.
Yeah, I mean, if I'd had a different childhood, I'd be a completely different person for exactly that reason. So it's always a difficult counterfactual, isn't it? I'm not sure. I mean, you do. It's almost a cliche now, isn't it, that people with well-rounded and happy childhoods don't become writers? So I think that must be there. I mean, it's an odd thing for someone who's written a memoir to say, but I haven't really inspected that too closely. I mean, I've certainly thought about my childhood, and a lot of it was very happy, but it was also quite solitary. So my brothers were five and 6 years older than me. And so we didn't really play together. So, you know, when you were 11, you wouldn't give the time of day to a 5-year-old. So I did spend a lot of time on my own. Yes. Doing imaginative play, riding around on my bike, pretending to be Zorro or Steve Austin or the wisecracking cops in Chips. And I think that probably almost certainly has made a difference in terms of the way my brain developed, I suppose, and the place that imagination has in my life. I suppose, you know, writers are just people who take their daydreams a bit more seriously than other people and bother to write them down, and And that's yeah, if you have a childhood where you never lean back on your chair and stare out the window and just get lost in a sort of thought of a daydream of whatever it might be, then you're not likely to be a writer. Yeah, I'd certainly say that made all the difference.
Yeah, and I also think the way you've just put it, just thinking about my own children, really, you don't necessarily have to superimpose tragedy or even you know, solitude in the way that you've just described to create that room for daydreaming. You know, boredom and time for daydreaming is so important for children, yeah. I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to see studies in about, you know, phones and tablets and, you know, there's a 20th century part of me that thinks, when do they get bored though? When do they get to, I suppose when they're dropping off to sleep, but that's kind of, you know, we've got these devices that just rush in and fill that gap now. But, you know, that's what I'm saying. There won't be any more writers now. We've had all our writers, ladies and gentlemen, and now there won't be, because of the iPhone, there won't be any more writers now. Yeah. So just enjoy the ones that were born before 1980.
You're the last one, Rob.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the new novel.
You keep saying the new novel is kind of...
Well,
kind of spooking me.
You mentioned it. You mentioned it a few times here. You mentioned it in the email. And you've said that you're writing this one sober. Tell me a little bit about that and how it's going.
Well, it's not going. I might have overstated this in the email. There's a folder on this desktop that I can I'm looking at now, optimistically called Book 3. It is quite empty. There is a notes app on my phone that I write in several times a day. Ideas for lines, ideas for characters, ideas for situations, ideas for, I mean, all kinds of things. And if I printed that file out now, it would probably run to 20 or 30 pages of A4. I mean, it's a weird, you know, I daren't even read it. It's, you know, at some point I will have to do that and then maybe cut all the little bits out and stick them in some sort of collage and see what jumps out at me. And I have sort of there is an idea which I'm circling, but it's without drastically wishing to lower the stakes of this podcast. I don't feel it that urgently, the need to make a start. I mean, the fact that it's taken me 3 years. So the first year, I mean, I had to have heart surgery and then it was locked down. So there's a couple of good excuses for the first year. So I get the first year free. Okay. But then since then, there have been 2 years where I can't help noticing I have not started a new novel. And it's, on the one hand, it bothers me because I think I do have something to offer and I would feel better if I was offering it. And I sort of feel I'm selling myself a bit short there. On the other hand, having had this experience with this diagnosis that I had, my mitral valve, one of the valves in my heart, wasn't working properly, and I got really quite close to my heart just failing, according to a cardiologist, and said, "You're not going to have a heart attack in the next fortnight, but if we don't fix this in the next few months, this heart will fail."
I read that. So, how scary.
So that was quite scary, but it was sort of immediately reassuring as well, because the same man was there to say, "We do this all the time. We know. I know who's going to operate on you. I know how it's going to work. It's going to be fine." And it was fine. But the information that I was given afterwards, which was that at some point the operation was supposed to happen on a Friday, and at some point there was a problem with the ICU beds. And so the surgeon wants to delay it till Monday. And then the cardiologist said to him, "Well, you could send him home for the weekend, but I wouldn't expect to see him back on Monday because I don't think he's going to last that long."
That's
information which fortunately I didn't hear at the time. But it turns out, you know, not wishing to be overly melodramatic, I'm kind of supposed to be dead. So if I end up not being in a massive rush to write my second novel, I think that's reasonably understandable. I mean, some people with that information, they would go completely the other way and they'd become very productive and they get all carpe diem about it. Whereas I was listening to Martin, not Martin, I was listening to another writing podcast. It was Ian McEwan talking to Sam Leith, and he was talking about his parents' generation and how they'd, you know, they fought the Second World War, and then they came home and suddenly they had a serious interest in mowing the lawn and collecting stamps. And that made me smile, because not that I've had to do anything as heroic as defeat the Nazis, but my body certainly went through this extraordinary trauma, this sort of 7-hour thing where it was on bypass, and you come back and you're not quite, they can't really tell you what that's going to do to your mood and your sleep and your resilience and your immunity and your memory. And you come back a bit wonky and a bit sort of reshuffled, and you recover from that, but that's, it's there. And so I've taken quite an interest in basically having a quiet life, with the odd mad overcompensation, like saying yes to Strictly, but with that wildly misfiring thing aside, generally I'm very happy getting through the day, you know, reading and going for a run and doing the shopping and cooking tea and just doing that kind of stuff. And so I really, really want to write some more novels, and it's irritating to me that I haven't started for a while. But there again, there's no enormous sense of urgency, because I'm kind of happy noodling around at the moment.
I actually think that's lovely to hear, not the heart bypass stuff, but yeah. The idea of a lack of urgency, which I think is often when people skirt around that idea, I think it sometimes is misinterpreted as people being lazy. And actually, urgency can be quite oppressive in writing and can stop good work, because people are trying to get it out too quickly. And I think that's really comforting to hear.
Yeah. I mean, there'll be people listening to this thinking what he really needs is a deadline. And I would sympathize with that point of view. It feels to me like I just don't want to go back into this unless I've got a much better idea of where I'm going than I do at the moment. And I think I'd like to, as with the first book, you know, get a long way into it before I showed it to anyone and I let anybody give me any money for it, because I sort of want to do it on my own terms this time before I have to worry about when it's got to be written by. So there is an idea, and I do like it, and it's just a question of finding the moment to just be brave and start writing. It's funny, because this time it's going to be like most people. Like I said, that, you know, the premise for Come Again spoiled me. And this time I'm going to have to do it like a proper writer, which is to, you know, you write the first draft that you're not very happy with, and you write with a sense of, you have to live with the uncertainty that I don't know whether this is a particularly good idea. I definitely knew last time it was a good idea. So it's just having the humility to live with that, not knowing if it's any good.
Yes, because a novel is such a long game compared with some other creative endeavours. Thank you so much for listening to Write Off. Do come find me to chat on Twitter, where I'm at Francesca Steele, and Instagram, where I'm at Francesca Steele Writes. I'll put that in the show notes. If you enjoyed Write Off, please do share it with others, and please, please, please consider leaving a review on the iTunes app, which really helps other people find the podcast. Thanks, and see you next time.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.